Welcome to Keeping 100 Radio. I'm your host, Lissy Pointer, type 1 diabetic, certified health coach, personal trainer, and founder of Needles and Spoons Health and Wellness. Inside this podcast, you'll find the real and raw conversations around diabetes management, including the lessons that we don't learn in our endo's office, my best tips and trainings, and conversations from the experts that I trust inside the community so that you can create more predictability in your diabetes management and feel empowered while doing so. Let's dive in. Welcome back to another episode of Keep 100 Radio. This episode is brought by popular demand. The other day, I posted an Instagram story asking your questions about Ozempic and type 1 diabetes, and let me tell you, the people have questions. There are a lot of questions about this, which made sense. Like, Ozempic and other drugs like this have become really popular in today's society, so we want to make an episode about my friend Kat's experience. So, before jumping into the episode, I do want to preface with some context of what Ozempic is and, you know, just kind of lead the episode with that. So for those of you who don't know, drugs like Ozempic, Trulicity, Mounjaro, and others are GLP-1 therapies, and these work to control blood glucose and weight. So how they do this is they block the release of glucagon, they stimulate insulin production, and they slow the rate at which your stomach empties, which therefore makes you feel fuller for longer. So this is basically an appetite suppressant. They're usually injected, but there are oral versions available. So GLP-1s have obviously gained a lot of popularity for their benefits. So some of those benefits include lowering your A1C. So these can lower your A1C levels by about 0.5 to 1.6%, provided that they are well tolerated. They're not well tolerated for everybody, so just something to be aware of. We do see in patients with type 2 diabetes a reduced risk of hypoglycemia. So unlike other medications, GLP-1s can reduce blood sugars without increasing your risk of low blood sugars. They also have cardiovascular benefits. So there have been studies that show that GLP-1s reduce cardiovascular risk in diabetes patients regardless of A1C levels. They've also been shown to support kidney function. And what they are most known for or most popular for are their support for chronic weight management. So because of the appetite suppression and you feeling fuller for longer, most users see a weight loss reduction of about 5 to 10%. So now the question has become, can GLP-1s be used in type 1 diabetes? We mostly see these being used in type 2 diabetes. So far, GLP-1 medications have not been FDA approved for individuals with type 1 diabetes, and this is due to the concerns about increased risk of DKA and hypoglycemia. So what I'm figuring that to be is that it's in conjunction with synthetic insulin use. However, some long-acting GLP-1s, such as like Victoza, Trulicity, and Ozempic, are occasionally prescribed off-label for type 1 diabetes. So in this episode, I'm chatting with Kat Looper on her experience as a type 1 diabetic who was prescribed Ozempic. So I want you to keep in mind that when talking about her experience, that this is exactly that. This is her experience. I have gotten messages that drugs like Mounjaro and Ozempic have been life-changing for people. So as always, I want you to talk to your own doctor. I want you to do your own research before deciding what is best for you and your diabetes journey. So let's do this. Let's dive into the episode. Welcome back to Keep 100 Radio. I'm very excited for this episode because I am interviewing or just chatting with a new friend of mine and a new member of the Needles and Spoons Health Wellness team, Kat Looper. We met honestly just on Instagram. I had posted a story just about, hey, we're looking for somebody to help us with email marketing, and you jumped right in. And honestly, I love everything about you. I love how cool you are. I love your personal and just how much you've jumped into the Keep 100 community. So I'm really excited to chat with you today.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
Of course. All right, so we're going to dive right into it. So obviously we know that like you are living with type 1 diabetes. Let's actually backtrack a little bit more than that. Tell us more about you.
Yeah, so I am in the Charlotte area. And like you said, I do help businesses with their marketing and email. That's like a side hustle, if you will. And then as you can appreciate, I'm starting my own business. I help individuals and businesses basically untie the knots they have around money so they can be their most functional, least anxious selves. So I wear a lot of hats, but whenever I slid into your DMs that day about working with Needles and Spoons, so much of my personal journey with type 1 diabetes has been in, isolation because I was diagnosed as an adult. For those who grew up going to camps and having resources and communities, that just wasn't part of my personal story. So having followed you for a while, I was like, oh my gosh, this is so enticing to me to be around other young adults and women who are figuring out their lives with this disease. Yeah, it's marketing work and it's writing, but it's so much of an overflow from what you and I experience and are familiar with on a daily basis. And I love it.
Yeah. And I love that you pull a lot of your personal experience into the work that you do. I think that's something that's really unique because when you hear the words like marketing, it just feels really icky. So at least when I posted that, I was looking for the right person of who can genuinely connect with our audience, who like understands the work that we do. And I felt that was such the perfect thing for you. But our journeys are actually really similar in that we are both like, that was when we first talked, I was like, okay, yeah, hands down, this is the person to join our team. But yeah, walk us through your journey a little bit and what that diagnosis looked like and your life with diabetes.
Yeah. So I was diagnosed back in late 2010. It was my freshman year of college. And I went to a school that has a 6-week break. We just got Thanksgiving through New Year's off. And that timing was honestly pretty divine in my circumstance because I got sick right around Thanksgiving. Sickness for me looked like all the telltale signs. I was drinking a lot of water, super thirsty. The only thing that could quench my thirst was simply limeade, which if you're diabetic is like the worst thing you can probably drink. I was peeing all the time. I think by the time I was hospitalized, I weighed 106 pounds. And it was the perfect storm. My mom was actually a diabetes nurse, like specifically worked in a diabetes clinic. However, whenever she tested my blood sugar with her glucometer at home, it had a low battery. So my blood sugar tested as 100. And we were like, do you have mono? What's happening? I'm sleeping like 23 hours of the day. And finally, I got to a point where I could barely even get down the stairs without taking a nap on the stairs landing. And by the time I got down, my resting heart rate was like 180 beats per minute. And we were like, we just have to go to the emergency room. In triage, the nurse was like, I can smell it on you, like your breath. I smell the fruitiness in your breath. You definitely have diabetes. And lo and behold, my blood sugar was like, I think in the thousands, like really high. Fortunately, though I was in DKA, I didn't have any other complications. And again, with that 6 weeks time, I was able to like crash course, learn everything I needed to know before returning back to school. And again, I think the assumption there in the healthcare or in the hospital system is, okay, this person's an adult. She's 18, nearly 19. She can figure it out. Here you go. Best of luck. So that was my diagnosis story, as it always is, was a whirlwind. I was on injectables for a really long time and didn't switch to pump management full-time until just several years ago. And luckily since then, the Dexcom has come a lot farther. It was like carrying around Lego blocks back in 2011. So yeah, things have come a very long way in my short tenure with diabetes. But yeah, I think everyone's story is similar in that it's just an absolute like hurricane there for the first little while. And it is alienating. You're a teenager, a young adult, and suddenly all of your priorities have shifted. And yeah, there's just a lot that comes with that. I always describe diabetes as just as much a mental and even social disability as it is a physical one, because it just requires you to engage so fully in the round in every aspect of your life. It affects your relationships. And yeah, it can feel all encompassing. But yeah, I've spent the past 11-ish years really trying to reconcile with that and get the tools that I need to feel less overwhelmed, feel more empowered, learn my body. Obviously, I'm not a doctor, but I am the expert in my own being, in my own body. Yeah, that's a lot of my story.
Yeah. And again, there's just so much overlap here of our journeys of I was 19, you were going on 19, freshman year of college, you're already trying to learn so much about being an independent person. And then you're literally thrown into life with diabetes.
Totally.
It's just interesting. First of all, was it limeade that you were? Oh, wait.
Yeah, it was simply limeade. Yeah. That was the only thing that I wanted to drink because it helped the fruity, acidic feeling in my mouth. And I would drink Coke because I, and I was not a soda drinker, but I would drink Coke just to stay awake because I was like, I remember being at Target pushing a grocery cart with my cousin and I fell asleep on a loaf of bread, like pushing the grocery cart because my blood sugar was so high. And I just thought I had mono or there was something wrong with me. I never fathomed it could have been this.
Yeah. It's for me, it was apple juice, which I'm not a juice drinker. Mm-hmm. I've always just been very like water. I don't know. And so that was weird to me of like, yeah. I would go out of my way to buy apple juice. So totally relate to that.
That's so funny. It's so funny. The longer that I've had diabetes and the more that I'm like present in these communities on Instagram, I realize that so many of us have the same little peculiarities. I remember feeling so seen when I first realized that no one changes their Lancet every time. Oh, I thought that I was just like a trash gremlin with my diabetes management. Okay, I'm glad that's a universal trait of most diabetics.
Literally has been at least since like early 2023. So that's changed mine. Probably.
Yeah, exactly.
That's so gross, but.
Yeah, truly foul. Can't recommend. Something has to give when you're managing type 1 diabetes. So
I'll let it be the Lancet.
Yes, it has to be. That's low on my priority list.
But I'm like glad that you mentioned the whole like, hey, diabetes is so much more than the physical part. There's so much like the mental component, the social component, that I think that's something really unique. And this is like an overgeneralized statement probably, but at least with being diagnosed as an adult, I feel like we recognize that a little bit more because at least people who I've talked to have been diagnosed as like a child or younger in their life, they just have it as a separate component of their life, or they like it's just in the back of their mind all the time. They're used to it.
Right.
Whereas with us, it's we already knew life as it was for almost two decades. Okay. With that being said, like you were diagnosed in the luckily you had the SIDS week break. Another part of that was you had your mom was already well versed in diabetes, which I actually didn't know. That's a blessing in disguise.
Like, yeah.
What did that transition look like? Like, how was she supporting you? How were you, how was that transition back to school once you went back? Walk us through that a little bit.
Yeah, it's so funny because I was always so independent. I was raised to be that way. I've always been. And so in many ways, I still carried on with that posture. And this was back before I didn't have an iPhone. I didn't have technology, didn't really support a ton of communication in the way that it does now. So in many ways, I just forged on. I didn't have an Instagram at that time, which I jokingly refer to TikTok and Instagram as my like continuing education on life. Like I just didn't have that. And I didn't know, I knew one other diabetic in my school program, which was like so exciting to me. I was like, oh my gosh, I have a friend. But yeah, to be honest, I think I just was in denial a little bit. I think I didn't feel like I was equipped to engage with it because to do so was to take on another identity that I just don't think I was ready to step into. I remember feeling just deeply ashamed for no one shamed me for having this illness, but I remember feeling, oh, I don't want friends to know that I have to leave right now because my blood sugar is higher. I don't feel well. I really need to go triage, figure out what's happening. And I think I just did a little good old ignoring. And luckily that didn't backfire on me too much in terms of being able to like regroup and overcome that. But I think I did the best I could with the tools that I had. And the good news about my college experience, I went to Savannah College of Art and Design in Savannah, Georgia, which is a beautiful place. And I biked everywhere. It was pretty active. I always lived in an apartment. And so I always did my own cooking. So I was able to have certain things within my control that helped contribute to my decision-making. I wasn't just eating cafeteria food that I had no idea nutritional values for, but there were other factors. Like Savannah is a swamp. It's so hot. And I found my insulin wasn't as effective because it was just so hot and humid at all times. And especially I had a pump very briefly in college. And when you have that tubing like on your hot, sweaty body for so long, it affects the efficacy of it. So yeah, I think I really had to figure it out, whatever that looked like for me. And I had friends who were as supportive as they could be and roommates who did their very best to understand and recognize how to care for me. But you know what? Life just keeps going. It doesn't really slow down. And I just really had to adapt. The year after I was diagnosed, I studied abroad in France for a few months. I actually look back at that time and I'm, do you ever look back at things you did post-diagnosis and you're like, how the hell did I think I could do that? And like,
all time.
Yes, that's part of, again, doing the best I could. But I went to France. Again, this is pre me having an iPhone. There was no Wi-Fi in this little town. And I brought a suitcase of supplies with all the things that I needed. And I made it work. I'm still here to tell the story. I made it work. But yeah, so much of it is just adaptation and trial and error. And as someone with a menstrual cycle too, so much of it is learning how every day is different. You know, you can find a standard of care that works for you in one season. And then in the next, it's not status quo anymore. So a lot of it is just learning and relearning. And something I talk about a lot with diabetes is self-advocacy. And that's a huge piece to the pie, is learning how to talk about it. That's just as important as learning how to actually have agency over your blood sugars and numbers and all that stuff. So yeah, again, a huge piece to the pie, and coming to grips with having this kind of disease is learning how to communicate about it. So I struggled with that for a very long time. I very much ignored that piece of it. And that's a huge critical part.
It 100% is. And it's, yeah, it's really interesting that I feel like we all felt this like ignorant. Ignorance. It might be love. Who knows? I feel like we all felt this ignorance is bliss kind of mentality at first.
Yes.
At least, again, like young adults in college. Like I definitely had, it may have played a part with what I was told at diagnosis. I'm not sure if you had the same conversations, but my doctor was saying, you can still live a very normal life. And I'm really glad for that mentality, but it made me feel a little bit more invincible of, okay, nothing needs to change about my life. All I need to do is add in this insulin piece. I wasn't on a Dexcom or a continuous glucose monitor. I would check my blood sugars leisurely, not really strategically either. So like I went to Penn State, very much a party school. I was still going out to the frat houses, going to apartment parties.
Yeah.
I was really lucky with having a really great roommate who had a more like an EMT background. Oh. Really, I remember one night we went to an apartment party and we had a lot of jungle juice, which again, not the best choice.
Yeah, but, diabetic or not the best choice.
Yeah, and you have no idea what they put in there at any of those parties. So my blood sugars were in like the 300s all night. I was not coherent. I was like throwing up, and my roommate literally checked my blood sugar. She saw that it was 300. She's like, you know what? That's better than you being low. So I'm just going to let you sleep this
totally,
off.
Like, totally.
Even the fact that she checked my blood sugar, I felt safe with her doing that. Like, I don't know. I just going back to the whole, like, do you ever think back to things that you did and you're like, like now I'm like, I would made sure that I like ate before and had my Dexcom going. Like you just,
That's so funny. That actually reminded me of a turning point for me personally. I didn't do a lot of partying in college. Again, we were all like very tortured art students and took everything way too seriously. But I remember in my mid-20s, actually, I would define that time as more of my like typical college in terms of partying or going out drinking, all that stuff. And I remember being, I was so drunk, but I was aware enough to have like little tidbits of stuff that was going on. And I remember being in a bathroom with not just one roommate, but three friends, all who were childhood friends. So they have known me my whole life. And they're trying to take my blood sugar. They don't realize that the tip of the lancet has come off. I'm not on a glucose monitor. They're trying to prick my finger, but they don't have the spring action. They're just like pricking it with a needle. Oh. And I remember them being like, someone get her a lemonade. Should it be diet? Should it be regular? And I just remember being like, I cannot do this to people. Like, this is just, I'm so grateful that they rallied for me and helped triage in that moment. And most importantly, didn't shame me for that moment. Mm-hmm. But I remember being like, I can't ever do this again to the people who care for me. It's just not fair. And it's not fair to myself either to put myself in that position. And that was just a massive turning point for me in terms of saying, look, I wouldn't choose this for myself if given the choice, but this is my situation and I need to be responsible for it. And now that doesn't mean being super rigid. It's funny what you said too about doctors saying you can live a normal life, because I remember hearing that too. But then they also gave me spreadsheets where I was supposed to log every single blood sugar, including like a 3 a.m. waking time. And I thought, like, the mixed signals here. So I'm supposed to live a normal life, but you want me to fax you my blood sugars with a 3 a.m. reading? I just couldn't reconcile the two. And I'm like, Surely there has to be some sort of middle ground where there's more like functional knowledge here. And there's a way you can support me without me needing to be so hypervigilant that the easier thing to do is actually be avoidant. Because that was my story. I was like, hypervigilance, nah, I can't do that. I'm going to go ahead and just be avoidant here instead. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't serve you either. So there has to be a happy medium.
Yeah. And I'm actually really glad that you brought that up, because the center around this podcast episode is your experience with things like Ozempic.
Yeah.
And I feel like that kind of ties into this weird middle ground or this weird relationship with the medical system and your clinical care. So I do want to pop into that, because you had going into your experience with kind of being prescribed this medication, mm-hmm. how it impacted your relationship with your body, relationship with your diabetes, relationship with your care team.
Yeah.
Do you mind, leading into that, of now 10 or so years later, you're mm-hmm. having this conversation with your endocrinologist, I'm assuming. Mm-hmm. What did that look like, that beginning conversation, that beginning transition there?
Yeah. Look, the question is so loaded. I think it's such an important conversation to talk about, though. And again, to be totally candid, for the months that I was on this drug, I don't think I told many people, because there's such just preconceived notions around it. It's obviously this huge thing in the media. It's talked about so widely in Hollywood and on the red carpet. It's award season right now, and every Instagram comment is like, oh, the Ozempic is Ozempicking with all these celebrities in their gown. It's tough. There's so much you have to filter through around this topic. So yeah, I suppose also my disclaimer here is obviously everyone comes to the table with a different set of clinical needs. And I find myself somewhere in this kind of tough space of, I need my endocrinology team and I want to have a good relationship with them. I'm at their mercy as far as getting the drugs that I need, getting a standard of care. And I often find that the standard of care is incomplete. And I say this not to be critical of my doctor, but to be curious about how this system can be improved, because it's just not, in my experience, serving people with type 1 diabetes to the best ability. So my doctor breached this conversation about a year and a half ago. And just for context, my own sort of clinical makeup, I have Hashimoto's, which is a thyroid disease, and I also have PCOS. So for those that don't know, PCOS, one of the big sort of pillars of it is insulin resistance. So in my particular situation, some of my care sort of mirrors how you might approach type 2 diabetes, at least tactically, when it comes to prescriptions and all of that stuff. So my endocrinologist, where it gets a little dicey is he suggested, based on my BMI, that I start taking this drug. Now, this, of course, comes with a lot of conflicting feelings as a woman, as someone who I have a personal history of eating disorder, which, by the way, was in my chart. So he knows this. It's so tough to sit in this office and have this man who is a doctor and who is the captain of your team here telling you you need to lose weight and you need a drug to help manage your care. That's a tough pill to swallow. And you're just, it just makes you, it puts on defenses when you're sitting in the room getting that kind of news. And as Lissy, I don't know if you feel this way, but I typically go to my appointments with just a little bit of anxiety. You're getting the report card on your sugars and all this feedback from people who usually don't live personally with the disease, but are the experts on it. And that's a hard thing to reconcile, right? So he suggests I take this drug. It is covered under my insurance, which is most people's struggle with it, because a lot of insurance won't cover it for you unless you have a physical need. Right now it's a medication for type 2 diabetes and for weight management. So I started taking this drug, and for me, really the challenges were, there were several challenges. The obvious, the nausea, the just fogginess, and the things you have to overcome within the first few weeks symptomatically before you're regulated on this dose. For me, very long story short, I did end up having tighter glucose management. However, it came at the cost of several things. One, I didn't feel safe to exercise anymore. I used to do progressive overload weightlifting. I remember one time I was in the mall, which you get more exercise in a mall than you think you do. Oh, I was in the mall walking around, and my blood sugar tanked so quickly, and the feeling of it was so scary. I dug a Sharpie out of my purse and wrote my husband's phone number on my arm because I was afraid that I didn't know if I could make it to the food court. And I've never felt that sensation before, where you just feel like the feeling. You're like, oh my gosh, I don't know how much time I have left. And I lost the trust that I had fought so hard for, even in my own recovery, with exercise and with thoughtful weightlifting, all of that stuff. I used to do a lot of HIIT activities that were very like shame driven. And yeah, I had this like such a good thing going with weightlifting and felt so good about how it affected my body. And then I couldn't exercise anymore because, again, out of safety, my blood sugars just weren't handling that very well. And I didn't have the tools to know how to modify my pump settings and really set myself up to succeed with exercise. And then furthermore, I didn't have the nutrition to support exercise anymore. On Ozempic, I was doing sort of a macro and a nutrient log just to make sure I was getting enough. On a good day, I could eat maybe 1,000 calories. I was getting an average of 30 grams of protein a day. And the best I could do was to eat really simple carbs, which nothing wrong with that. It was just, I had to eat the things that were the least complex, which then in turn meant not really nutritionally diverse, not a whole lot of fiber, not a whole lot of fruits and vegetables. Again, very simple. Everything else tasted like sand. So all of that to be said, the interesting thing is that over, I think it was nearly a year's time, I lost, I think, 17 pounds. Some of that I'm certain was muscle because I'm like naturally a muscular person. And more anecdotally, that makes me wonder, okay, I understand my BMI shares one story, but the reality is that this drug is helping people who really need to lose weight for whatever reason, lose 40, 60 pounds and keep it off. If I, over a year's time, eating very suboptimally, maybe 800, 900 calories a day, lose 15, 17 pounds, this is not the way my body is meant to carry weight. The muscle mass that I had, the composition that I had, was not meant to be whittled down any further. And again, this is just me doing the work to pay attention to myself and listen to my own biofeedback. So I found that interesting. And again, the cost of having the tighter sugar management, having lost some weight, the cost of that for me was I actually was really struggling to stay asleep. I was really struggling with my mental health. I got married that year. And if I'm really honest, I was so anxious. I was really depressed. I just struggled to connect with people. I struggled to feel like myself. I felt like a shell. And it wasn't until my husband, who is such an incredible partner in the sense of just making me feel so like seen and safe in having type 1, he just very gracefully and gently was like, look, I don't think this is worth it. It's just not. You're not feeling like yourself. There's no way you're supporting what your body needs when you're eating this little. There's just no way. So I approached the subject with my doctor, and we regrouped, and I was like, look, the ends don't justify the means here. This is something that has really come at a cost to me. One of our goals clinically, one of the reasons why he had me on this, was for prepping for fertility. It was his opinion that if I lost X amount of weight, that I would be more primed to have children. or to carry a healthy pregnancy. Of course, the fine print here is that Ozempic is actually, there's not enough research right now on Ozempic to determine whether or not it's toxic to pregnancies. In order to consider getting pregnant, you have to detox for at least 12 weeks. That's the safest bet to make sure it's fully out of your system. So I sat there and said, look, tell me if I'm understanding this correctly. The goal is to lose some body weight so that I can get pregnant, which, again, caveat there, he didn't ask any questions about my PCO care. He didn't have any questions about my nutritional intake, my exercise. He was only looking at the number on the scale. He was not asking about cycles, ovulation, hormonal imbalances or balances. He didn't know what that picture looked like. So I asked him, I said, is the goal to take this drug so that I lose some body weight, am able to then come off for 12 weeks to give my body a chance to detox, then to ask my body to conceive a child and then healthily grow that child, birth that child, breastfeed that child if that's an option for me, and then go back on Ozempic? Is that, am I understanding correctly that this is the treatment plan? And he said, yeah, that's essentially it. So I don't know about you. I tend to sometimes freeze in my doctor's offices and just take the lashes and walk out. I sent him a note in my chart, my like electronic chart, because I just wanted it in writing. I was like, I want to make sure that this is like what I'm understanding. So I just said, hey, dear doctor, can you confirm that Ozempic causes weight loss because, I just want to clarify, is it because of the stomach emptying? Is it because it has a hormonal impact? Is it because of all of the things that it does? Or is it simply mostly because you're eating less food? It's a caloric restriction. He said, yeah, you lose weight because you're eating fewer calories. So I said, okay, so if I'm understanding correctly, this will be really clear. This drug is being recommended to me so that I can eat 800 to 900 calories in perpetuity, because it's designed to be on in perpetuity, minus the weeks that I have to detox from it to try and conceive. I'm just not sure that works for me when it comes to all the things you sacrifice along the way, like bone health, mental health, mineral balances in your body, mineral deficiencies. And of course, no surprise, I did a hair mineral analysis after coming off, and all of my minerals were like severely low.
When you're not able to
consume.
Okay. So I don't know if you can cover it. I'm getting heated because, okay, for anybody listening, to put it into perspective, 800 to 900 calories is less than what a toddler eats.
Yeah.
And when we're looking at, just the math ain't math in here for me.
No,
because
it's
when we're
not
looking at something like a hormonal imbalance, PCOS, again, I'm not a doctor, but to me, it just doesn't add up where you're looking at PCOS, which is a hormonal imbalance. You're looking at your ability to improve your fertility and to conceive. Your body needs adequate calories to support your hormones. We know that eating properly, eating enough, and eating a good balance of foods and including micronutrients and vitamins, that improves hormone health. So why are we encouraging people to be on drugs like Ozempic, which are, maybe it works for some people, again, very situational.
Sure, absolutely.
But for your situation, it doesn't seem like it really made the most sense for you. And I'm curious, with that initial conversation where he wanted to prescribe this, did he give you any other options? Was there any, hey, let's have you meet with a dietitian. Maybe let's see what we can do as far as your exercise plan or your nutrition plan. Like, was there anything else that he was giving you as an option, or was it just like a prescription for weight based off of your BMI?
Yeah, great question. So look, my doctor, I don't want to like just shit all over, standard of care. But and to his credit, my doctor does ask at every appointment. He always asks, what would you define as your biggest barrier to care? And I so appreciate that question, because it is really important. And if I'm totally honest, what I want to say every time is, actually, you might be my biggest barrier to care, because I knew when he was offering that drug, I already knew based on our prior engagements and conversations that I was not interested in any advice he had to give around nutrition or exercise or any of that kind of management. He has told me in the past, he's looked at my pump downloads, and if I eat any more than 100 carbs a day, he says that's way too much. And again, for reference, every body is different. I prefer to do weightlifting exercises. I need to fuel that activity. Food is fuel. And if I want to support muscle growth, and importantly, if I want to support recovery and not sacrifice all my other systems, mental health, sexual reproduction, health, all of that stuff, I need to be able to eat to keep all of those systems online, hair, skin, all of the things. They all need nutrition to fuel them. So I knew going into it, and this is where I feel like that's my responsibility, but I knew that I wasn't that interested in what he had to offer as far as his standard of care went. And I also knew that I think I just put it in the column of, hey, I am so tired all the time from having to self-advocate. The last place I really want to do it is here in the doctor's office, where I already feel really vulnerable. And I already feel like, how do I convince the expert, the person who's done all this schooling and who is really so smart, how do I convince this person that, hey, I actually might know better than he does in this situation, that I've hired other coaches who are very dialed into what my body needs to support my hormones and to support my overall health. So I guess to answer your question, I'm sure he would have given me those resources had I asked for them, but I wasn't super open to it. In fact, something that I had brought up to him several months into the medication, Ozempic can make you dehydrated, and that is because you're sometimes consuming less water. Again, anything that you have to put in your mouth and consume, it's just not, you don't want it. Like, you're just so disinterested in fueling your body because of the way that your stomach is emptying so slowly. Several months into taking Ozempic, I actually had to go to the emergency room because, stay with me here, a little TMI, I was severely constipated because I was severely dehydrated. And on top of that, I had a cyst at that time, an ovarian cyst. And the amount of pain that I was in was so severe because those two things were irritating one another. Stayed in a waiting room overnight, got it figured out. And when I went to report that back to my doctor to say, hey, I do have some concerns. One, I've never had a cyst like this before. So that seems, can we maybe discuss some correlations? This thing happened to me. What do you make of it? And his response to that was that he really wasn't interested in making any sort of correlations to other areas of my health and engaging with the questions that I had around PCOS and bringing some curiosity to, like, how did I find myself here on Ozempic? So all of that to say, you could say that I struggle to really trust my provider in the way that I think is so important to. And that certainly affected my outcome here. So whenever I did share that I wanted to come off of the drug, of course, that's my choice. And he said, fine. And at my next appointment, he said, look, I know you came off of this, but I'm going to write this prescription for you again. And you can pick it up whenever you want. I think you need to go back on this. And I'm so grateful that after a year, I went, absolutely, there's no way I'm going back on a drug that, for me personally, the ends did not justify the means. Mm-hmm. I have spent this past year really trying to earn back the trust that I feel I lost with my body as a whole system. One of the things that I am so grateful to have earned back is the daily bowel movement. Like, seriously, you don't realize until you're not having them how important they are, even just for, like, your body's natural detoxification. And so grateful to say that is no longer a struggle that I have. My husband and I can enjoy cooking and meals together. And yeah, relationally, just I feel more engaged with people because I have the fuel to do that. And you know what? It's it's tough because the 17 pounds that I lost, I have now, I think I've gained 30 since coming off of this drug. All of that has been while monitoring my personal caloric intake and needs. And I don't blame it's frustrating, but I don't blame my body for being like, hang on now, we got to hold on to a little extra because I was so severely malnourished before. I remember the first time I took a walk after coming off of Ozempic, I remember being like, oh my gosh, I have energy for this walk. I didn't have energy for a walk before. I have an Australian Shepherd who needs a lot of time outside. And I remember just being like, this would have wiped me out months ago. So the connection back to me, even in my moments where I'm frustrated because my clothes don't fit the same, or in this season at least, I'm like, you know what? But I wouldn't trade that for feeling like an absolute shell and for having a bit tighter, if you want to call it quote unquote, control over my blood sugar. Because you know what? I would actually argue it's not control if it only works in this tiny little vacuum, which is on this drug. That's not control, actually. It's not healthy control. I would way more rather make empowered decisions about my health and decisions that are functional and sustainable. And for me, that drug was not recalibrating. This past year for me has been a lot of recalibrating, a lot of healing, even the mindset that brought me to that place to begin with that thought, oh, this could be a good thing for me. Like, I wouldn't mind shedding a few pounds, whatever sort of messed up mindset I had around that. But yeah, it's just, it's not control if it comes at the cost of all the things that make you enjoy life and enjoy your relationships and feel like you can show up for yourself, for your friends, for your family, for your work. It was not worth it for me.
I want to tattoo that on my freaking forehead. It's not worth the quality of life. And going back to something that you said of like how if you would eat 100 carbs, it was okay, that's way too many. I do think that there is this medical bias.
Yeah.
Okay, I'm an actually very petite person. I've always been living in a smaller body. I'm 5'2". My body is naturally smaller.
Yeah.
I eat about 200 grams of carbs a day. When I walked into my endocrinologist office or any doctor's office, if they asked me about my carb intake based on my body, they don't even bat an eye. Me, it's just, as you mentioned before, the weight or the number on the scale does not tell the whole story.
No, it doesn't. It absolutely doesn't. It doesn't even tell the story of body composition. Because to your point, you're 5'2", you're super strong. You have a body composition that one is probably genetically just something you were predisposed with for better or for worse. You were made to be able to build muscle, like lean muscle. And for me, what we're not discussing in my doctor's office is I am naturally more muscular. I also have, I'm like dragging a wagon. I got a big butt, like a very muscular butt. Like,
I've never heard that.
That's my favorite term. Like, body comp is so important to this conversation. BMI is just a completely misled and incomplete picture. And it's not actually serving a patient clinically to decipher what their best options are. It's just, it's outdated, needs to be reformed. I could get on my soapbox. That's the hill I'll die on. But yeah, body comp is, it is so important. And it's so interesting to me that you bring up the sort of, let's call it privilege of being in a more petite body saying, hey, I eat 200 carbs. They go, oh, fine. That's not, that must not be contributing to your body weight. I find that so interesting because the assumption when you go into an office, if you're in a larger body or a more muscular body or a body that carries weight distributed differently than others that they've seen, the assumption is always that the culprit is food or that the culprit is carbs. And, you know, if I could advocate for people with PCOS for a moment, we've spent so much of our lives clinically being told to diet and exercise. And the truth is that when you chronically diet as someone with PCOS, it actually can have the adverse effect on your body composition that you want it to have. Yep. It can actually cause more resistance to weight loss, if that is a goal for you. It can cause more inflammation in your body. What we should be talking about is your quality of food. That's what we should be talking about, quality of food. We should be talking about fueling for whatever activity is important to you. We should be talking about rest and recovery, supporting your menstrual cycle if you have one, supporting your goals with your family, if children are even something you want to have. That's not a question I was ever asked. It was just like, hey, you need to have kids soon, so you need to lose some weight. Right.
You got married, you're in childbearing years. When are you like?
I must want some kiddos. The conversation needs to be so much more complex and honestly human than it is. So yeah, I do. I find that so interesting. My doctor has never once asked me, hey, can you break down your caloric intake? The assumption is just, oh, you must eat too much because your BMI is a little suboptimal. So anyway, I have such a love-hate with medicine. I think it's fascinating. I think it's necessary. I think I do have a lot of respect for the training it takes to be a professional in that space. Mm-hmm. And yet I think that there's just more work to be done.
Yeah. And like you said, this is not a place to shit on your doctor. There are good questions that they do ask, right? But
absolutely,
it is this systemic issue of your doctor doesn't have enough time to spend with you because there is a severe deficit in endocrinologists.
Yes.
So it is this vicious cycle. And that's why I'm so glad that you took the time to rebuild your own relationship with your body and with food and just being able to increase the quality of life again. So if you don't mind, can you take us through what were those steps that you took to rebuild that? Yeah, rebuild those things and get back to the things that you love.
Yeah. It really started with just, like I said, I had that very low moment of just come to Jesus with, okay, this is not working for me. And I knew I had to make the switch. So a big part of that was the support system I had with my husband, just saying, look, I needed to name that I wanted to enjoy life more. We're newly married. We had trips planned. We just had a wedding that I really struggled to feel like fully present for. And I had to grieve that a little bit to be like, look, it's just not worth it. I had to really just experience feeling a bit in the trenches. Coming up for air from that, I really focused on just nutrition. So not calorie counting, none of that. I really wanted to focus more on sort of micronutrition. Like I said, I had done a hair and mineral analysis, which showed up, the results there were that I was just severely low on a lot of different areas, one of which was magnesium. And magnesium correlates directly with, it can correlate with anxiety, with depression, with your quality of sleep, with your bowel movements. So it was no wonder that I was really struggling in those areas. So I worked with a team that helped focus on those shifts while taking the pressure off of my body to have like peak performance. Let's be really scrupulous about your calories and about weight management and about, no, it was about doing a bit of a triage, being really soft with myself, being gentle with myself and saying, okay, there are these things I need to tend to that I have ignored. So yeah, that just, it looked like remineralizing in ways that were effective. It meant thoughtfully taking some supplements. I'm definitely not team take 200,000 supplements. I think I'm also team test, don't guess. You're best served having tests performed to help inform what you do take. And then from there, it was a lot of the mental game of just being like, okay, let me reconcile me back to my body that cares for me and holds me up and serves me even in moments where I feel like it's not working well because of this disease that I have. How do I really make friends with myself in this time, despite it being tricky? Like there were a lot of hormonal shifts going on coming off of these drugs. My menstrual cycles really fluctuated during this time. For about a year, I had really like debilitatingly, cripplingly painful periods where I couldn't even physically walk, just so painful. And a lot of that, again, correlates with your levels of certain vitamins and nutrients. So anyway, it was a bit of a slow burn for me getting back to me. A huge part of it too was just being like, okay, we don't need to step back in the gym and get ripped real quick. Like, I need to focus on just being outside, getting some sun on my face, taking a few walks a day, prioritizing gentle movement, grounding movement, just enjoying and being present outdoors. Little things that I had just like really neglected because I didn't have the energy for them. And then out of that, probably no surprise that I've redefined some of my own work and I'm stepping into more of a season for myself where I'm really excited and redefining what my career looks like. And I could not have done that a year ago. There was no capacity for it, no energy for it. A lot of it is having grace for yourself. I'll see my endocrinologist again in, I think, a few weeks. And yeah, I think it's going to be interesting approaching that appointment and just really doing the mental prep work to be like, look, I know that I'm doing my best. My best isn't perfect. That's okay. It never is perfect. Here's how I'm showing up for myself. And you know what? It's okay if he misunderstands that, because that doesn't invalidate the work that I've been doing to be more of the person that I want to be.
Yeah. And I'm like really glad that you're mentioning all these other things that you're doing out. Yes, there's the nutrition piece, there's the gentle movement piece, but then there's the work that you're doing on your career and all these other areas of your life. Those do impact your management. I remember when I was going through that, we call it, from a health coaching perspective, we call that the circle of life, so to say. And there's all these other areas of relationships, social, financial, education, all these other areas of your life where if those aren't feeling 100%, that's going to affect your overall well-being.
Yeah.
And what I noticed is that when I took care of those other areas of my life, my diabetes management improved.
Yes.
And I was more open to learning more about my body because I was no longer judging it for what it couldn't do in these other areas of my life. So I'm really glad that you're taking that approach of let me look at my holistic, like my life as a holistic opportunity to dive in more, because I think that's going to make the biggest difference. What I'm curious about is now that you do have your appointment coming up, how are you preparing for that? How are you going to navigate that conversation if the weight management comes up or, if there's any conversation there?
Practically speaking, a couple of things. I think that, again, sometimes I've made the mistake of going into an appointment and I haven't done a practical check-in with myself of what questions I want answered, what questions I have. And that means literally writing those things down, because it's very easy to feel derailed in an appointment, especially when my doctor is actually very generous with his time, which I very much appreciate. We're usually in there for sometimes 30 minutes together, which is great. Usually the standard of care is 15, but then you're out of there. So I'm going to write down any questions that I have that are relevant to my diabetes care. I have learned that this is his lane. That's totally fine. I'm not here to ask questions about nutrition, weight management. That's just not the thing that I'm frankly paying him for. So I'm going to work on a set of questions for him specifically. The other tool that I like to use is his nurses are angels from heaven. They're wonderful. I don't look at the scale when they weigh me. It doesn't serve me. It's not usually even an accurate representation of weight, because you're there at 2 p.m. after lunch with your sneakers on the day before your period. And it's okay. This is not real. Yeah, truly. Like we all fluctuate so much just during the day. So, and I don't know if your scale is calibrated. I don't know, but that's just a boundary that I have for myself. I don't need to look at the scale. If he asks questions about my weight management, then my question to him is, this directly affecting, are we talking about this in relation to how I need to dose my medication? Is this a diabetes related question? Or is this sort of another line of inquiry? Because I'm just not open to talking about that with him. Mm-hmm. Similarly, with our journey with fertility, I am, and this is just, it is so sensitive as someone with diabetes, because as a woman and as someone with diabetes, you feel that external pressure of time, like the whole internal clock, all of that. Mm-hmm. Right now, my husband and I are not trying to be pregnant. I don't want to be pregnant this year. I'm not even sure about next. Quite frankly, I don't need to be having conversations about preparing for fertility with my endocrinologist. It's not top of line for me. The discussion we had a couple of years ago now, or a year and a half ago, about Ozempic was directly related to him saying, do you want to have kids in the next year or so? And I was like, I don't know, maybe. And so he prescribed this drug to help me for that. It's not a priority of ours. We don't need to discuss it in this appointment. Mm-hmm. We just don't. Yeah. I have some wins to share. I just got my retinal scan and my eyes look great. And I'm very happy to report that to him. We can talk about pump management. I have other lines that we can discuss, but there are just certain things that are going to be off the table. And I'm fine to give vague answers if he has questions about them.
And I like that you're drawing the boundary, but you are not just saying, hey, this is off the table. It's more mm-hmm. so of like, how does this relate to the yeah. topics that I'm bringing to the table right now? How does right. this relate to my pump management, mm-hmm. my dosing, etc.? So yeah. I love that so much. And what I want to dive into right now, obviously the overall experience that you have had with Ozempic wasn't necessarily a very positive one, but sure. there are situations where it can be positive depending
absolutely.
On absolutely. Let's just say somebody is looking to inquire with their doctor about this, or maybe their doctor came to them saying, is this something that you want to do, or I want to prescribe this. I just want to take a second to, what would your advice be to people that are currently having these conversations when making this decision?
Yeah, that's such a good question, because Ozempic is not evil, okay? It's not a terrible thing. It's helping a lot of people. It's in fact increasing quality of life for people, which is fantastic. That's the outcome you want, right? You want a drug that you take to increase your quality of life, help you engage better with people, have better relationships. So yeah, if that's something you're interested in, I think that's just the question you have to ask is, hey, what is actually my end goal here? What are my holistic goals apart from just weight management or blood sugar management? What do I want my life to look like in terms of, again, relationships, financial? Because Ozempic is not cheap either. Sometimes your insurance covers it, sometimes it doesn't. What do you want your stress levels to be at? How do you want to address stress from a holistic kind of way? I find that the conversation specifically around weight, it's just an incomplete conversation. And the goal always needs to be more than weight loss, I think, if it can be. You just have to ask what comes at the cost there. And I think too, what I wish I knew going into taking Ozempic that maybe would have changed things for me is I really wasn't thinking about the micronutrition. I wasn't thinking about minerals. I wasn't thinking about how to support those systems that are compromised when you're eating less. So I would have a game plan for that. This drug does really curb, it doesn't just curb your appetite. It makes food feel like a burden to even eat it. Know that. Know that going into it, if you're someone who loves cooking and being around the table and connecting with people, that is going to be compromised by taking this drug unless you have a game plan for how to try and incorporate that back into your diet thoughtfully while taking this drug. Those are all things I didn't consider. I think you have to also ask yourself, am I willing to be on this long term? I'm seeing just, again, I'm not a doctor, but anecdotally with people I either look to see online or whatever. Some people are saying, like, I took it for a time, came off of it, and have been able to keep my weight off. I don't struggle with food addiction anymore. It's been so good for me. And that's fantastic. That's wonderful. Some people may need to be on this drug in perpetuity for it to be effective for them. Right. So the questions that you just have to ask going into it are, am I willing to be on this really long term? What is my game plan to supplement the things that are lost as a result of taking this drug nutritionally? And if so, what is my game plan to make sure that I have the mental health support that I need, the nutritional support that I need? Am I in a place mentally where taking this drug is a good idea for me right now? For me, it's in my chart that I've struggled with eating disorders in the past. That was not discussed in my appointment, which right. I think is unfortunate. And to be honest, I probably wasn't going to be, it already felt very tender to me to be able to say, hey, this is something that needs to go in my chart to begin with. I'm probably not going to be like, hey, doctor, let's reference the point in there that mentions I've had eating disorders in the past. Yeah, just know that there really is no such thing as a magic pill, a magic dose. Yes, is it something that's really helping people? Absolutely. But there are other things you have to really dial in and pay attention to make it overall a successful choice for your health.
I think that goes with anything. Be skeptical of
Yeah.
everything. Be skeptical of what you put into your body. Be skeptical of coaches online. Be skeptical
Absolutely.
of just anything that you're going to allow into your life, your diabetes management, your
Yeah.
overall health and being. Be skeptical of and do
Yeah.
your homework, do your research, make sure that it's the best option for you and your journey. I'm so sorry that the experience wasn't a positive one, and I'm sorry that it sounds like a lot of things were overlooked and but now I do think that there is that positive of you are so aware of what your needs
Yeah.
are when going into your doctor's office. You're very aware of what your needs are when allowing things into your diabetes journey. So,
Totally.
and now you're helping other people also be aware of those things. So I really appreciate
Yeah.
it.
If I were to look at it as the most generous, positive way that I could, I think the truth is that obviously part of me in that initial appointment when I'm being offered this thing, it's so enticing. You think, this is great. My blood sugars are going to be tighter. I'm going to maybe lose some weight that's been quote unquote stubborn or whatever. And of course, you're like, I can take a shot for that. That is a punchline. Of course, I would want to do that. And I think I needed to go through that to understand that for me and my relationship with myself and with my health, there is no silver bullet. It is something that takes management in multiple areas. And ultimately, I feel so much more functional of a human when I'm doing the work and taking the responsibility for myself to be nourished, get the movement I need, connect in ways that are meaningful. And I think I needed to learn that. It's brutal, but for me, the net positive there is that, look, being in a smaller body temporarily actually caused me more trouble than what I thought it would bring me. Even having, and this is controversial take, even having that lower A1C, it came at the cost of my mental health. That is not a net positive outcome. It's just not in the long term. Definitely
No.
not in the long term. So I needed to know that. I needed to have that takeaway. And it's something I've heard you talk about too. Mental health, if your A1C is tighter, but you're raked over the coals to get there, that's not in the success column, even if clinically you're being praised for that.
Right.
I had several people, and this is not at all blaming anybody because everyone is just doing the best they have with the context they have. But I had other doctors praise me for, oh my gosh, it looks like you've lost 15 pounds. Great work. That's fantastic. You've worked so hard. Congratulations. And I'm sitting here going, I'm withering away. I'm not doing well. And this isn't a result of like hard work or you earned this. No, for me, this is actually coming at such a cost. And again, this is where our system just needs to be overhauled because prioritizing thinness as the ultimate sort of mark of success is just backwards. So anyway, it's
So,
lesson learned for me for sure. And I know that many people's lives are being very improved by this drug, and that's fantastic. But yeah, just be informed.
yeah. And again, I think the work that you're doing now, like you mentioned, if you didn't go through or when you were living that experience, would you be where you are now with your career shifting and
Oh,
everything?
yeah,
Like,
no.
probably just the work that you're doing now. I'm so
Yeah.
excited. I'm so excited that you are in our community. Just
Yeah, me
even
too.
bringing you here, that's, I don't know, to me, that's on the side of a win. I'm so
100%.
excited.
No, 100%. That alone has brought me so much more fulfillment than seeing like my A1C drop temporarily because of having, I feel like I have what you and your team are doing is giving people so many tools that just aren't available in the standard care approach because you've lived it yourselves. And yeah, you just know how to thoughtfully supplement the medical standard. And again, like our doctors are not set up to succeed in how they can care for us because of the way that our healthcare system is designed. So no shade on them. It's just so much of the onus as someone with type one is learning what works for you and getting tools outside of the standard care of or approach to care. And that's exactly what you guys are doing.
And you get to help us do that. So I'm so excited. Thank you.
Yeah, of course.
Seriously, thank you for taking the last hour of your day to be on the podcast and like sharing your journey. Like when we were talking about this, I just felt like it was a really important conversation to have. Yeah. So I'm really thankful that you were open to being so transparent and being so honest about your experience. And I'm really excited for other people to hear this.
I appreciate that. I think so much of my last thought here is so much of my story early on with diabetes was, again, what I talked about, the avoidance piece of, oh, if I don't look at it too much or don't talk about it too much, it's not really there. And I definitely dealt with that, was reacquainted with that with my Ozempic journey. And it's so tempting to tuck it away and be like, don't acknowledge that thing because it's messy. But there is healing to being transparent and to hopefully helping people engage in conversation more thoughtfully. So I just appreciate the invitation to do so.
Yeah, absolutely.